Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 25 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we take an inside look at some of the diverse and surprising ways in which contemporary writers support themselves beyond their writing lives. Here's My Other Career. Whether it's a public ambition or a private dream, many aspiring writers hope that one day they can quit the day job and make a living from their writing. The truth is, though, this has never been easy. There are plenty of well-known writers, particularly poets, who've had to maintain a paying job alongside their writing, and plenty more who've chosen to keep up a parallel career for personal reasons as much as economic ones. Famously, for example, T.S. Eliot worked in banking and Wallace Stevens in insurance. Jorge Luis Borges and Philip Larkin were career librarians. William Carlos Williams and Arthur Conan Doyle were practicing doctors. Lewis Carroll was a mathematician and a teacher. Thomas Transtromer, a psychologist. And Anthony Trollope worked in the post office and in fact introduced the pillar box to Britain in the process. In My Other Career, we'll be looking at some of the ways in which RLF writers are earning or supplementing an income and how this affects their writing. What is the best day job for a writer? As most professional writers will be all too aware, earning a viable income from writing alone has become more difficult in recent years as new technologies disrupt traditional publishing models. Here's the novelist Fiona Shaw.
Is it an advantage or a disadvantage for a writer to have a side career outside of writing? Whether it's a disadvantage or advantage is a little bit irrelevant for almost every writer I've ever met. It's essential. It's what pays the rent and puts the food on the table. There are very few writers I've met who can make a living just by writing their own work, and that's become more so in my life as a writer. I could earn a better living for myself writing novels 20 years ago than I ever could now. It's increasingly difficult to make any money out of writing, out of your own work, in my experience. That may change again because the landscape is changing so fast, but it's pretty bloody difficult at the moment.
The uncertainty and irregularity of writing income can be a major source of stress. And sometimes even the dullest of day jobs can provide welcome stability. The poet Robin Bolam appreciates the security of a second job.
I'm not quite sure how it works, but when you don't have stability, I think your writing does suffer. Once you don't have to worry about paying the bills and just, you know, what's going to happen next, you can get on with long-term plans.
Of course, not all writers want stability. The non-fiction writer Max Adams positively relishes the chanciness and freedom of being an uncareerist.
So what is a career? I don't know, really. A career is as long as you can get away with it, without going under. And of course, there are times when you do nearly go under and you think, oh, stuff this. But the other good thing is that at the age of 50 plus, as a bloke, you're never going to get a job anyway. You know, everyone says, oh, get a job stacking shelves at Tesco's. They're like gold dust. I used to do that. I've done all the other jobs as well. So I have stacked shelves at Tesco's in my youth. I packed razor blades in a razor blade packing factory and biscuit factories. I used to clean the rancid butter out of biscuit trays without any detergent. That's an interesting job. And then I worked on a production line in a toy factory. It's an education. And all those jobs matter. I mean, all those careers. And in the end, of course, it's united in one single career, which is the career of getting away with it, which I pursue steadfastly on the grounds that there's nothing else you can do, really. Nobody's going to give me a job. And that's quite good if you can get away with it. So that's it. That's my career, getting away with it. And I suspect, I have strong suspicion I'm not the only one.
Like Max, many writers didn't start out in life with a writing career in mind. Here's the novelist Jane Fever.
If I hadn't been a writer, when I was 8 or 9, I wanted to be a nun because I loved the black habits. Then I grew out of that, decided I want to be a lighthouse keeper again because I loved the idea of living in a lighthouse. And then when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a 1940s laird's wife. I think I rather like the idea of being a kept woman on a wild Scottish island.
Jane eventually ended up in a writing-related job, but found that a para-authorial career might not be such a good idea.
I've pretty much had another career all along. I mean, I was a very late developer in terms of writing. So before I was writing at all, I worked in a museum in Oxford called the Pitt Rivers as a sort of counter of pencils and badges. I worked in a bookshop. I ended up working for a dozen years at the publisher Faber and Faber, which does sound like a sort of dream job for a writer, but in a way was the opposite. I was in charge of the poetry slush pile, which was a hideous job because as much as you would cut it down, it would grow up faster, vaster the next day. So it would be as tall as a man every day and you'd have to be reading and sending it back, reading and sending it back. It did make writing seem like a ridiculous, mad occupation.
The children's writer Harriet Caster found that her own childhood ambition came to fruition in an unexpected way that resonated with her writing life too.
If I hadn't been a writer, I would very much like to have been a dancer. I went to a full-time dancing school. Actually, before that, I wanted to be a cricketer and a nun, but that was when I was six. But then I wanted to be a dancer. And although I was never good enough to make it as a dancer, the dance world did come back to me. As so often with writers, I've had to do various other things as I've been a writer, sometimes part-time, sometimes full-time. And one of the things that I've been privileged to do is train as a dance notator. And I ended up working at the Royal Ballet for 3 years. I found dance notation fascinating. A lot of people don't know it exists even, but it's a graphic language whereby you can write down any physical movement from the curling of a little finger to 40 dancers leaping across the stage all at the same time. And it got me looking at things in a new way, I think. The notator has to sit, watch the dancing, and then analyse the movement and decide how they're going to write it down. As with words, there are several different ways within the language of notation that you can describe a movement. But I love that creative aspect to it, that you're sitting in the room with a choreographer often while they're working, and you are not only literally writing down the steps that the dancers are doing, but you're listening to what the choreographer is saying, listening to the way that the choreographer wants to emphasise the movement, and deciding, according to what you've heard, what is the best way to put it on the page. And that has so many parallels with writing.
The joys of music are there too for poet Jo Shapcott when she imagines an alternative career.
I would have loved to be a singer. The sheer exhilaration of opening your throat and hearing that sound come out. And I felt that for both myself as a young woman singing, but also vicariously hearing my words set and hearing a fabulous singer suddenly produce these sounds that originate in words I might have kind of quite humbly written. It's a shivery and wonderful moment.
Sometimes having a different early career teaches you something important about yourself or your writing. Starting life as an archaeologist taught Max Adams about the dangers of professionalising your passion.
I seem to remember when I was about 9 saying to my mother that I wanted to be a drummer like Buddy Rich and an archaeologist like Mortimer Wheeler, God forbid. So when I was 14, my mother sent me on a dig. And I ended up in a field in Dorset wearing a pair of white jeans, really not the right thing to wear on a dig. And I was sort of taken in by these rather genteel folk. So I went back every summer for into my 20s. So that was it. I was always going to be an archaeologist. And it was only my very late 30s that I just walked away from the profession, not from archaeology, because that's something you can't walk away from, like music. It's there, it's in you. And I think archaeology should probably be like music. You're much, much better off being an amateur. Once you turn it into a profession, you basically stuffed yourself. You are then a slave to gig schedules, or in archaeology, commercial contracts and all that sort of thing. And you're better off being an amateur at everything.
Like Max, Robin Bolam also chose an early career that didn't quite work out. She thought her chosen profession would be uniquely suitable for an aspiring children's writer, but she was wrong.
My first career was as a librarian, and I think I believed that that would be a good ruse for a writer. When I was younger, I grew up in a village where there was a very nice small library, and I had a feeling that the person who ran it sat in the back room and wrote children's books all day, and that was what I wanted to do. It never happened, because when I trained, and I did become a chartered librarian to start with, I believed that I would be writing and have access to books to read all day. And the reality was that I ended up as a cataloguer and became a postman in effect. I was posting the books onto the shelves, shelving them, and I was cataloguing them and seeing very little more than the front page, the title page, and a quick glimpse through to be able to put a subject on them. So it was a big disappointment in that sense. It was a fine job, but it didn't allow me to do what I hoped to do, which was write.
Sometimes simple decisions about work can have unexpectedly far-reaching implications. Novelist Alex Martin found that his whole worldview was shaken up when he casually took on a job as a festival organiser.
I don't know if you can call this a career, really, but I did once have a job as an organiser of a festival. I had done quite a lot of organising of things when I was working in the theatre, so I knew something about bringing people together and creating a sort of rehearsal schedule. Organising a festival is a similar kind of thing. You've got to organise when things will happen. It was a festival of the waterways in Oxford, and I thought it sounded rather easy and rather fun, and there was some money attached to it, so I did it. And it was incredibly challenging. It made me completely reverse my philosophy of life, which I think is always a good thing, actually. I was a Taoist before that. I believed that the best way of achieving what you wanted to do was more or less to get on with it quietly. Don't force anything. And if things didn't work out, well, never mind, you'd find another way. A great image in the Tao Te Ching, which is Lao Tzu's great textbook of Taoism, is imitate water, which always takes the lowest path and always gets to where it wants to go. Anyway, I found that even on a festival of the waterways, it's no good imitating water. You've got to imitate dynamite. You have to motivate people. You have to get out there and do all those things that Sebastian Coe did to make the Olympics such a success, and that, you know, captains of teams have to do. And you have to be really earnest, and you've got to mean it, and you've got to fire everybody up with energy. And it's absolutely exhausting, but it's exhilarating when it works. And I discovered as a result of that, you know, anybody who puts on an event, particularly a festival, is essentially a martyr, really. It is the most exhausting thing you can possibly imagine. And I learned a great deal from it, and I'm actually very grateful that I did it now, although I'm also very grateful that I don't ever have to do it again.
Perhaps because of the necessity of finding different ways to earn money, writers often imagine themselves in other careers. Sometimes these can be a long way from the writing life. Here's novelist Katie Grant.
Might it be better to have two completely separate careers? Midst novel, I often long to be a shelf stacker at Sainsbury's, where somebody else tells you what to do, because both journalism and novel writing are things which require huge amounts of mental energy. Sometimes just the idea of putting, you know, cornflakes in a pile on a shelf is very, very appealing. But had I not been a writer, I'd like to have been a ballet dancer. I love the discipline, the pain, the contorted weightlessness. As you can see, I've actually never been a ballet dancer. I'm not very coordinated. But I think I could have been trained not to be good, but just to, you know, through the pain and the contortions. I would have liked that. Or I would have liked to have been a concert pianist, the discipline again, which I like. But I don't have the talent or the courage. You're so exposed as a musician, as a soloist. Or perhaps best of all, I'd like to have been an opera singer. But sadly, my voice is still like a small girl's voice, and I'm not cut out to be a diva. Being a writer is to be imperfect. With ballet or the piano or the opera, you could, I think, give one perfect performance, and that is tremendously appealing. As a writer, that never, ever happens. But still, a writer is what I am, and I wouldn't really exchange it for much else.
Sometimes writers have two careers in parallel, but writing can also displace a pre-existing passion. The poet Pascal Petit started life as a sculptor, and she still feels occasionally wistful about her lost first vocation.
When I was a child, I knew I'd have to be an artist, but I was totally torn between becoming a poet and becoming a visual artist. So I did decide to go to art school, and I went to art school for 6 years. So I became a sculptor, but ultimately I found that image and metaphor in poems won over materials in sculpture. They suspended disbelief better and made more of a magical other world. But I do miss the studio situation. It is still very much an alternative career, a shadow career.
A challenge for many writers is to find a parallel career that fits harmoniously with their writing life, that makes sense in some deeper personal way. The poet Ian Duhigg seems to have found this happy interconnection.
Well, after leaving university in 1978, I started working with homeless people in various projects in England and Northern Ireland, until I was finally made redundant from a project in Bradford that closed down in the 1990s, although I have kept in touch with the issues and people in the field ever since. It is a truism that writers feel alienated from their homes in one way or another. When I worked in the field and had to give talks on what I was doing, I would usually say that while the idea of home was elusive, if not illusory, homelessness was a very brutal reality. I'm not sure if it's quite as simple as that, but there is some level of psychological truth in there. I'm forever quoting Wallace Stevens as saying that we don't live in places, we live in descriptions of places, which puts so well what I've been struggling to find words for. It connects my work with homeless people with my interest in poetry, which, as Joseph Brodsky wrote, derived from the song of the nomad as opposed to the prose of the farmer.
Fiona Shaw, on the other hand, likes the idea of doing something totally unrelated to writing.
If I was to talk about what my ideal side, so-called side career was, what my ideal other career would be one that had nothing to do with writing and no word, and it had and as few words in it as possible. So my ideal other life, or the other half of my ideal life as a writer, would be to work as probably as something like a gardener, preferably in a team of gardeners, where I wasn't the boss, so that I would just do what I was told. I'd have skills, but then I could just go and prune something or dig something up or lay something down. And I would be outdoors, I'd be in the natural world, which I love, and I wouldn't be using words all the time.
When looking for something to support themselves, teaching of one kind or another is a career that many writers either choose or fall into. Is teaching a good second job for a writer? The poet and translator Hilary Davies certainly thinks so.
Yes, I have had another career alongside writing. All my adult life I've been a teacher, variously, a little bit in further education, mostly in secondary education. This was a deliberate choice on my part by not being dependent on my writing for my income or to support my family. It gave me enormous freedoms, and so teaching was the perfect profession. The holidays are long enough that one had time to do research and write. So that's the reason I actively chose to go into teaching rather than fall into it. My two parents are teachers, and of course I swore I would never become a teacher, as one does. But in fact, it has sat very well with the writing career for many, many years. And I'd almost certainly do it again, because I can't think of another profession that would offer such long periods of time for writing.
Jo Shapcott is a little more ambivalent when it comes to writers teaching creative writing.
Now I teach, like many poets in university, I teach creative writing part-time, which is great. And the advantages to that are the chance to talk about poetry a lot, and to talk about poetry with young poets to find out what's interesting them and what other poets they like. And that's something that keeps you fresh and on your toes and is fantastic. Disadvantages, I feel, to the growing movement for creative writing in universities is maybe, I hesitate to say this, but maybe a lack of diversity in the kinds of poets coming through, in that perhaps, as in the States, most poets will have gone through an education in the academy and will probably expect to get a job there. Whereas when I was coming through, poets had all kinds of mad jobs. And I think the variety of work that stems from that is great.
The poet John Siddiq has actually given up teaching creative writing because of the negative impact on his own creative work.
I'd like to just be a poet all of the time, or a writer all of the time. But life doesn't kind of work that way, and money doesn't work that way. So I've always had to kind of have extra work or other work. And in the past, I've tried to kind of stay very close to writing. So for a lot of my writing life, like many people, I've taught creative writing in schools, in universities, workshops at festivals and things like that. The thing is, though, that I just don't want to do this stuff anymore. I've had enough, actually, and I'm walking away from that world. The problem with creative writing in school or universities or wherever we do it is that the writer is emptied out. And by having to come up with ideas to run the sessions with, one's own creative energy is going over to that instead of the work. And so I think sometimes it's much better to kind of be in a quite a different area. You know, if you have to earn some money in a different way, do it in a different area. I can remember very early on when I started out writing, I used to be the person who took x-rays around Manchester Royal Infirmary for a particular clinic. And I got to flirt with nurses, walk around with my trolley all day, and I had so much space for thinking things up. I've never been so happy in my life.
The non-fiction writer Catherine McMahon initially thought that teaching would be a good job for a writer, but she found it didn't suit her at all. She went in a rather less common direction afterwards, one that proved surprisingly fruitful.
I've got a rather surprising other career. When I first wanted to be a writer, which was really when I was a student, my mother, of course, said to me, you're never going to make any money. You need a fallback position. So I trained to be a teacher, and it was really apparent to me very quickly that teaching was totally the wrong thing for me. I think it's very hard to be a very good teacher if what you're wanting to do is to write, because it draws on the same kind of creative energy that you need for writing. If you're teaching well, it's incredibly time-consuming outside school. And so I had various jobs to make enough money to be able to write at all, because I wasn't being published at the time. So my favourite job was taking breakdown calls to the RAC, which was great because it was all little dramas. You know, everyone who rang up was in some moment of crisis, and it was great. But when I was pregnant with my second child, I really realised that I needed something in my life other than writing, because I felt terribly useless. I still wasn't published. I still wasn't making any money, but I didn't really have a place in the community. And I'd been brought up to think that really you had to be of value to society, and I didn't feel valuable at all. And I happened to be reading a Cosmopolitan magazine. That shows you how young I was. And there was this article in it about magistrates and about how they were looking for women and left-wing women to be magistrates, young women. And I applied once I'd gone down to watch a magistrate's court, because I found it absolutely fascinating. And the reason that it's fascinating to a writer, I suppose, but to anyone, is that these people who turn up in court are at moments of crisis in their lives. Everybody's going through a little drama, and it can be an important drama if somebody's liberty is at stake, if somebody's risking going into prison because of what they've done. It can be a small drama if they've just gone through a red traffic light. But for that moment in court, it's a very human exchange. And since that moment, I've been a magistrate for a great many years, really. And it has led me to all kinds of other adventures. I was able to combine teaching and magistracy because I trained magistrates for a long time. And now I sit on the sentencing council. So
together with a panel of judges and other members of the criminal justice system, we write sentencing guidelines which have to be used by magistrates and judges across the country. And I also serve now as a judicial appointments commissioner, so I look at the process by which judges are appointed. So it's given me a whole other life. And for me, it's really nourished my writing. I don't think I could be a writer without having that other career, because I always, after a while when I'm writing, feel that same sense of being cut off and being vaguely useless. But also, I think these other things that I do really feed my writing, especially as a novelist, where it's all about human interaction, building characters, understanding characters, drawing on characters. And I never use real life experiences from other people in the courtroom, and I never use people directly in my books, but inevitably I am getting a greater understanding of what's going on.
The novelist Sally Vickers is also a practicing psychoanalyst, and she has something similar to say about how the drama of working with actual lives can nourish a writer.
It is, of course, an enormous privilege to hear the secrets of another person's heart. It's commonplace nowadays that the modern analyst is a kind of version of a priest, and I wouldn't like to say I'm a priest, but there's something profoundly moving, actually, about hearing people speak about those things closest to their own minds and hearts that they've never confided in another person. So it's a very privileged experience. I certainly have never used material from anybody that I worked with psychologically. I don't mean that I haven't used the insights I've gained, but not their material, which I think is a different thing.
Perhaps this connection with real life is one of the greatest benefits of the writer's other career. The hard-won insights, the painful or joyous experiences, the inspiring or quirky or infuriating characters are all submerged in the writer's inner creative pond to be one day fished out again, transformed into writing. What better example could we finish with than this first job story from novelist Jonathan Tulloch?
My other career would probably have made me stunningly and joyously obese by the age of 22, or given me a criminal record. It was Carr's Biscuit Factory. Everyone worked there in Carlisle. I was assigned to the Rover line, you know, Rover tin biscuits. But I'd only been working on the Rover line for a week when I was promoted to quality control. No one else would do that job. "Aye," said Tiger, the line manager. "It's a queer cushy bad job, this only thing is, you'll have to do it with Copper Crack." Copper Crack was a ginger-haired matriarch of the Bourbon Creams. She ruled the factory. Beside her, Tiger was like a kitten. "All right," I said, "I'll do it." So, every day at work, I roamed the factory on Copper Crack's overall tails. Because basically, quality control was, is this biscuit tasty? And you had to like tick it, is it crumbly? Does it melt in the mouth, right? Copper Crack, on one day, ate 300 Bourbon Creams, right? Which I could match on a good day, right? The next day, I had a biscuit hangover, which is awful. But we grew bored of the job. So we started inventing our own categories to quality control, such as, would this biscuit be better with tea or coffee? Or is it Ovaltine friendly? And then we said, well, could you recommend this biscuit as an après-piste aperitif? That factory was, I was going to say it's gone now, you know, in the sort of typical Vulture Doom way, but I don't think it has, right? Maybe Copper Crack's still there. There are other characters I know are still there. One of them called Darren Sharkey, who lived about three doors down from me when we were growing up. He actually turned out to be all right and was the second person who I did quality control with, but he wasn't interested in biscuits. All he was interested in was his likeness to the lead singer of A-ha, which you may or may not remember, a Danish band, and the lead singer was called Morten Harkett, right, who had his hair in this absurd sort of quiff. And Darren always used to go, hey, do you think I look like Morten Harkett? Right, he'd say that to me about 10 times every day. I just said yes. Other characters there, and this is where the criminal record comes into it, was this lad, he said to me, you're a writer then, eh? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you've been on quality control, eh? So you must be a writer with the pen. I said, oh, yeah. He said, do you want a computer? I said, what do you mean? He said, I know where I can get you a computer, a word processor. I can get you two. Just tell us what make you want. So I said, no. I actually know that he's ended up in jail, and maybe for one of these thefts. Once he said to me, like he came in late, and he was ashen and panicking, and he said, do you know anyone who wants a van load of gold bars there? I've got to shift them. Luckily, it turned out that the gold bars were one of the biscuits that we make, right? Not actual ingots. Like, but he'd somehow, because we used to buy gold bars on piece, you got them in like black bin liners because they were offcuts. Over 3 weeks, he'd filled this van, right, with gold bars. He'd stolen them and he was going to go and try and sell them. I don't know what his name was, but he always used to call me boss. Maybe it was ironic. But I look with fondness on those days in the chocolate factory.
That was My Other Career. The featured writers were Fiona Shaw, Robin Bolam, Max Adams, Jane Fever, Harriet Caster, Joe Shapcott, Alex Martin, Katie Grant, Pascal Petit, Ian Duhigg, Hilary Davies, John Siddiq, Catherine McMahon, Sally Vickers and Jonathan Tulloch. You can find out more about all of them on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 25, which was recorded by the Writers Aloud team and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 26, the children's novelist and playwright Anne Coburn speaks with Kona McPhee about her writing life, the challenges of travelling theatre, and her faith in the future of reading. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.